This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking about cars and all the driving apps this holiday weekend. What apps do you use to get around the city? We want to hear from you what your favorite driving apps are. So get ready for that. But first, the food chain. The oceans are key to survival of life on our planet, and lots of the nourishment for life in the oceans starts with plankton, microscopic creatures at the bottom of the food chain. Now, you want to keep the plankton happy and healthy because they also produce about 50% of Earth's oxygen. So what happens if plankton find themselves at the mercy of a virus? And get this, in just one mouthful of seawater, there are 200 million viruses, but they're not there to attack you. They are interacting with the plankton in the water, and scientists are getting greater insight in how viruses impact plankton and the ocean's overall health as a result of the TARA expeditions. That's a multi-year study of the world's oceans aboard a 110-foot schooner. The results were published in a special issue of the journal Science this week. Joining me now are two scientists who worked on that research, Matt Sullivan, Associate Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona, and Jen Brum, a postdoctoral researcher in the same department at University of Arizona, both joining us from KUAT in Tucson. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for the opportunity for being here.
Yeah, hello.
So you study the oceans and you're landlocked in Arizona. How do you square that?
We're just 100 million years too late.
That great inland sea, huh?
Yeah. No, it hasn't really limited us. I get to go around the world collecting samples from places such as Antarctica and off the coast of Canada. And we also get a lot of samples sent to us from around the world, like through this TARA Oceans Expedition.
Matt, let's talk about the TARA Oceans Expedition. How many scientists involved? How did it get going? How long did it last? Give us the ABCs here.
Well, it began to me when I was just starting my lab, and I went to Monaco for a conference, and Chris Bowler spoke about a handful of scientists who were about to sail around the world and study everything smaller than fish larvae to try to understand how these plankton that you spoke about earlier work and how their diversity is distributed around the world. And I gave a talk about viruses, and Chris said, hey, we haven't been thinking about viruses yet. So that's how it started for me. And it's really been one instance like that after another. What was a few scientists back in 2008 is now hundreds of scientists. And then there was a 3.5-year expedition where we had systematic sampling.
Jen, how many new viruses did you find out there?
Well, so far we've been able to detect about nearly 5,500 viral populations throughout the world's oceans, and really surprisingly, only 39 of those nearly over 5,000 populations we could identify as being similar to something that are in our databases from cultivated viruses. So the most abundant and widespread viruses in the world's oceans are unknown to us. We don't know what they're infecting.
Yeah, and of course you're interested in their genome also, correct?
Yes. Part of that those populations were defined based on comparing the assembled genomes of these viruses. And so when we say we don't know what a virus infects, that's because when we look at this genome of these unknown viruses, most of the genes in that genome have no similarity to things we've seen before and that we can identify.
So, like, we talk about the human microbiome, all the bacteria and viruses that live in our gut, and then we talk about the same thing in the soil has one. You're basically identifying the marine microbiome that's out there.
That's right.
Yes, for the microorganisms, we refer to it as a microbiome. For us, with marine viruses, we use the word virome. So
the virome, I like that.
Yes, the virome.
Matt, tell us the process you go through to identify the new viruses in the virome.
It's actually a really hard problem. For about 2.5 decades, we've been able to count viruses out there, so we've had a good idea of those numbers, like the 200 million per mouthful seawater. But it's been a real challenge to figure out what is a type. How do you discern what organisms are actually in this water? So in this study, we actually tried to develop a way to look at large sections of genomes and compare them against each other and against known viruses and ask how that can define different groups that we're looking at. So these we call populations.
Mm-hmm. And are they the same viruses that are everywhere, or did they travel around the globe, or do you find different populations in different places in the oceans?
Yes. So many of the populations we saw were found in many places throughout the world's oceans. So, for example, we collected samples from 26 locations around the world, and some of our populations were found in 24 out of 26 of those locations. Mm. So what that's telling us is that these viruses are being transported around the world, and we found that they were that transport was closely related to the oceanic currents. So these viruses are sort of riding the currents around the world, and they're increasing or decreasing in abundance depending on the environmental characteristics such as temperature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, are the viruses, are the plankton in jeopardy from all these viruses?
No, the viruses are a natural part of the ocean ecosystem, and so they would they're capable of probably infecting every form of life in the sea and probably any ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So we don't worry about them being in jeopardy. I think one of the interesting aspects of this study and some of the companion studies in the special issue is that temperature is a major driver of the kinds of viruses that are there or the community structure. And if that's true, then as we warm the oceans from climate change, we actually are going to be shifting the balance, so to speak, to different kinds of microbes and different kinds of viruses.
So global warming is also affecting the virome of the ocean.
That's right. Absolutely.
In ways that we don't know yet?
In ways that we're just beginning to map. In this study, the 5,500 populations, we now can look at their distributions and correlate that with things like temperature to ask which viruses should we expect to be there. Unfortunately, as Jen mentioned earlier, 39 of those are identifiable, so most mm-hmm. of them will be unknown, but these offer great targets for thinking about experiments to try to understand mechanistically what's happening.
Now, viruses work. They really take over. I mean, when you get a cold, the virus takes over your cells and puts out all the gunk that you do, coughing and sneezing. How does a virus co-opt an ocean microbe to produce stuff, and what does it make?
Viruses can just infect a cell and take over the cell's machinery to make more viral particles and lyse it. And I think one of the surprising findings that's happened recently is that most of these viruses, when they do that process of takeover, they actually need some key metabolic gene. So, for instance, a virus that infects a photosynthesis cell actually has core photosynthesis genes. And it needs that because it probably needs access to the kind of metabolic products that cell produces. Hmm. We're now expanding that from photosynthesis genes to all of central carbon metabolism, nitrogen cycling, and sulfur cycling. And these are the basic biogeochemical cycles that fuel the ocean's ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell anything about the health of an ocean's ecosystem by the viruses in them?
You could, I guess, if you had any indicators of human pollution, and there's a lot of work done to think about colophages, which are viruses that infect E. coli bacteria. Mm. So if you saw viruses that are infected humans or human-related microbiome, since you mentioned that earlier, that would be an indicator. I would say we don't have a sense yet for what a healthy state community-wide looks like, though this first map would be a good place to start thinking about that.
Jen and Matt, what most surprised you about these viruses?
Oh, I think the definitely the most surprising thing was that we saturated the number of genes that we could identify, which means that beyond 30 samples, as we added more and more samples to our gene catalog, we weren't identifying very many new genes. So we only identified about 1.4 million viral genes, which is about 1,000-fold lower than had been predicted from earlier studies from very few locations. So I like the fact that this is now no longer sort of a mystery of viruses are endlessly diverse, but in fact we now can actually put numbers on this and sort of bound it as a problem that we can investigate.
Isn't that the same thing what happened with the Human Genome Project, where they found that a much smaller number than they thought they would find?
I'm sorry. I don't know that.
Okay, let me ask you.
But if they did find a smaller number than they thought they would find, then yes, that would be highly similar to what we did.
Yeah, because
it was very surprising.
There's a lot more stuff you can make with those with the smaller genome. It's more of a plastic, you know. Oh, but there was something about the structure of the viruses, Jen, that surprised you, wasn't there?
Yes. So in addition to sequencing the genomes of these viruses, we also looked at the viruses from each of these samples around the world. We did that using electron microscopy. And surprisingly, normally we think of viruses that infect bacteria as this sort of lunar lander shape. They have a capsid, the head, they have a tail, and they use that to descend upon the surface of the cell. But instead, we see that most of the viruses in the ocean don't have these tails. It's just that capsid head. And we're still trying to think about how to think about this, because that's not similar to most of the viruses that infect bacteria that we have in cultivation.
Mm-hmm. Matt, anything really surprising for you?
Yeah, I guess for me, I've been thinking a lot about populations or these viral types that are out there. And so when we found only 5,500 viral populations, that was surprising, because we're talking about the global oceans. And so I was doing some back-of-the-envelope calculations with another one of the lead authors yesterday, Simon Rue, who's a postdoc in the laboratory. And he suggested that 5,000 number, when we look at what we were able to see versus what we think we should eventually be able to see, we could probably extrapolate to be 25,000 to 100,000.
Wow.
Both of those numbers, though, are still much smaller than people would have expected, because a paper half a dozen years ago had suggested there were 100,000 types in just one seawater sample.
Wow.
So it's neat to think about the problem as being bounded.
And those 200 million in your mouth are no problem for you, right?
That's
just
right.
Let everybody know that
if
they're going swimming this weekend, it's okay to get those 200
million. Swallow the water.
Absolutely.
The salt is much worse for you.
All right. Jen Brunn, a postdoctoral researcher in the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology Department at the University of Arizona. Matt Sullivan, an associate professor in that same department. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, and have a happy holiday weekend.
Thanks so much.
For having
and
us.
People can see the plankton art at sciencefriday.com/plankton if they want to go to our website. We're going to take a break and talk about the moon blowing up. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, there are some famous first lines in novels so succinct or even jarring that they make their way into literary history. Call me Ishmael, or it was a dark and stormy night. And I suggest we add to that list this understated zinger. The moon blew up without warning and for no apparent reason. That's the explosive beginning to a new novel called Seven Eves, just out from sci-fi writer Neal Stephenson. That event, the breakup of the moon into seven big pieces, kicks off 800 pages of love, death, and heavy-duty engineering as humankind races to save itself from certain death from a storm of fiery moon rock. How will they do it? By building a cloud ark, a swarm of space habitats to carry humanity into orbit, and maybe one day back down to Earth 5,000 years later. Neal Stephenson is the author of Seven Eves and past books including Snow Crash and The Baroque Cycle. Welcome back to Science Friday, Neal.
It's good to be here, Ira.
Nice to have you. Did that first line come to you fully formed, or were you in the shower one day and said, hey, that's a good opening line?
No, this was a case where I knew it had to go, the moon, that is. I couldn't quite figure out how to break that news to the reader. And sometimes, rather than, you know, clearing your throat, it's best to just kind of get on with it.
You know, of all the apocalyptic things that have happened in science fiction novels and movies to the Earth, and, you know, even global warming staring us in the face, why did you pick the moon to destroy the Earth?
Well, it was driven by the requirements of writing a space arc novel, which turns out to be pretty demanding. If you're going to write one of those, you have to blow up the Earth. Otherwise, there's no reason to build an ark. But there's got to be some warning time. You know, if an asteroid comes out of nowhere and kills everyone tomorrow, we don't have time to build an ark, so I can't use that. Mm. And if it takes hundreds of years, we would probably just solve the problem. And so you've got to find something that'll that'll do the job, but do it with enough advance warning to build an arc, but not enough to just do something else.
And when the moon is blown up and it gets into pieces, you give the moon pieces funny names, Mr. Spinny, Peach Pit. How do we go from that to global apocalypse?
Well, at the beginning, we have a character in the book who's a kind of a science popularizer. He's a completely legit Caltech astrophysicist in his own right, but also the kind of person who goes on the Today Show to explain science. So needless to say, somebody like that is going to get a phone call when the moon blows up. So he is trying to kind of calm people down a little bit and put kind of a human face on the disaster by giving these things non-threatening names. But after about a week, one of them breaks in half during a collision with another. And so now there's eight pieces instead of seven. And the natural thing for a scientist to ask at that point is, well, if seven could turn into eight, then eight can turn into nine, and so on and so forth. And if that were to go on unchecked, could we have a sort of exponential sudden breakup of all of these pieces that would lead to a whole lot of rocks coming into the Earth's atmosphere?
Is this something that you discussed with scientists as a real possibility?
Well, certainly not the moon blowing up, but the place I got the whole idea was from reading about the problem of space junk, which is man-made stuff that is in orbit, things like spent rocket boosters and dead satellites and things that astronauts dropped during spacewalks. And there's a fair amount of that up there, thousands of pieces of it zooming around at high velocity. And every so often at random, two of those pieces will bang into each other and fragment into more smaller pieces, sort of going off on random orbits. And the specter has been raised by actual legit scientists who've studied this problem that it could sort of go exponential and lead to a situation where there were so many little particles of debris zooming around in orbit that we wouldn't be able to journey into space anymore in the manner we've grown accustomed to.
People who read your stuff know that you are among the kind of science fiction writers who don't like to break the laws of physics. There's no warp drive. There's nothing like that that we could not possibly create on our own. Well, why stick to that code?
Well, I can easily see myself someday writing a book where I do violate the laws of physics. But I think you have, whether you do or you don't, you sort of have to be systematic about it and follow the rules. So in this case, once we get over the initial setup of blowing up the moon, which frankly is kind of an implausible event, I wanted to tell the rest of the story as much as I could without recourse to kind of magical technologies that would make problems go away, teleportation and hyperdrive and that kind of thing, because that is what imposes constraints on the characters and forces them to make choices and to kind of dig deep and summon their resourcefulness.
Now, they know that they're going to have to stay up there for 5,000 years. Did that present a challenge to you to make it sort of believable that people could live in an orbit around Earth for 5,000 years and have enough food, supply, stuff like that to stay alive and come back?
Well, fortunately for people like me, space enthusiasts and scientists have been studying this kind of problem for quite a while now and have done a lot of work trying to figure out how crops could be grown in space, how we could make sustainable life support systems. And that's the kind of library of knowledge that those people, the fictional characters in the book, would have to draw upon and build upon and improve upon in order to achieve their mission. So rather than having to really invent anything new, this is largely a matter of asking, okay, if I were a real engineer today and learned I was going to be sent up into an ark, you know, what would I Google? What would I look up?
Of course, in your novel, Seven Eves, they stick very close to the Earth, these space journeys. Why did you not send them to Mars like, you know, maybe Isaac Asimov would or other science fiction novelists? Has that been done too much?
Well, I don't know if it's been done too much. It's sort of a basic question, actually. Now, among people who like to think about going into space, there's sort of two ways to do it. You can go to Mars and land on the surface and use what's there to make a place to live, or you can stay closer to Earth and you can make use of in situ resources, which in this case means asteroids and comets. And you can construct the stuff that you want the way that you want it. And that's actually kind of an interesting cultural divide. There's reasonable arguments to be made either way. But in this case, the timeline is short enough that it kind of makes sense to just get people off the ground as quickly as possible and then take stock of things and think about where to go next.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the second half of the book. The second half of the novel jumps forward 5,000 years into the future. And now we have to think about what kinds of tools we're going to have and what the Earth would look like and what would you build on this new Earth. And one of the predictions you make is that people won't rely as much on rockets to get around. Why not?
You know, I have mixed feelings about rockets because I know people who build them, and I've sort of in a very modest way kind of played around with them myself. And so I'm appreciative of just how unbelievably difficult it is to make these things and how much ingenuity goes into to making them work. But at the end of the day, they are limited by some basic considerations of thermodynamics and chemistry. You know, how much energy is it possible to get by burning a couple of propellants together? And, you know, they're also kind of inherently dangerous and scary. There's a lot of highly pressurized fluids. There's things that are extremely hot, things moving really fast, and so on. So there's all kinds of good arguments that in a later stage of our technological development, we may look for the next generation of machines for getting around in space, and that they might not look very much like rockets. They might be big machines instead.
Mm. Some of the people in the future, what's kind of interesting is that they're not too keen about social media.
This is when you write a book, you never know what people are going to find interesting and key on. And this is a thing that's gotten a lot of reaction from readers. I mean, I should say I believe that all technology is really, you know, it's what we call path dependent. You know, the particular mix of technology that surrounds us today didn't come about through a highly rational series of plans and decisions. The whole petroleum industry started out with guys sailing around on wooden ships throwing harpoons at whales. Okay, mm-hmm. That is the basis for the oil industry. And when we ran out of whales, then they had to figure out ways to replace whale oil with synthetic stuff, and they began pulling oil out of the ground. So that's just an example of how weird the history of technology is, mm-hmm. and there's all kinds of ways that things could have come out differently. Mm-hmm. So in positing a future culture 5,000 years from now, I think it'd be a bit odd, and it would read as kind of naive and false to just assume that culture would make exactly the same set of choices in the same order that we did.
I have to, before we run out of time, I have to talk about a few things that I thought were kind of cute, if I might phrase it that way.
Okay.
I love the Sears Craftsman tool reference in the book without trying to give anything away. why you chose that symbolically?
It's funny how when you take a commonplace object and bury it in the dirt for a few thousand years and someone digs it up, it's suddenly imbued with all kinds of solemnity and mystery, and you know, it becomes a much more important thing than it ever was to the original owner.
Because there's nothing more iconic than a craftsman tool to anybody who...
Well, to you and me, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I just barely got it in under the wire.
But you also have 5,000 years in the future, one of your characters reading a paper novel. Paper probably is going to last longer than any CD-ROM we have or whatever. Was that the point you were trying to make, or is it something about the thing that it's a book?
Well, the book is a is one of the most, maybe the most highly evolved technology that we've got, just by virtue of being very old. So the book, you know, the codex, the book in its current form is over 1,000 years old, and it's undergone a continual process of refinement the whole time it's existed. And so it's a whole bundle of innovations that somebody had to think of and carefully kind of imbue into that thing. So things like typefaces and how they're designed, and kerning, and just the whole art of typography. It's all a technology. It's very advanced, and it works really well. So I think it's, although it might seem anachronistic on the face of it, I think it's totally reasonable to put books in the same category as any other highly evolved technology, and have them being used right next to all kinds of, you know, whiz-bang, you know, high-tech gadgets.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Not to give too much away, but the humans you write about 5,000 years from now are modified. Their genomes have been tweaked to favor certain traits that the people who left Earth thought that they should have. But is this new version of the humanity that they create, is it really better than the old version?
Well, that is, in a way, the fundamental question of the book, Ira. And so if people walk away asking themselves that and talking about them, then I feel like I've succeeded. If they walk away feeling like I've been feeding them a pat answer, then I've probably failed.
Last time you were on the show, you were working on an anthology of hopeful science fiction, stories that could inspire scientists and engineers to think big. This is a much darker book, though. Did you still have that goal in mind of inspiring readers to think bigger in this book, or are...
I guess I used up all of my hopeful ideas. I had to let it go. It actually is the later part of the book, and even a lot of the part that reads like a disaster novel, is actually compatible with that vision. I mean, obviously there's a terrible disaster underway, but it's not a human disaster. It's not that kind of dystopian thing. And the way that people respond to it is by sort of thinking big and thinking ingeniously and being resourceful and making use of what's available to them on kind of an epic scale. So despite the darkness of it, I actually think there's a pretty clear through line that you can draw from Hieroglyph to this.
You sort of ended kind of abruptly. Mm-hmm. Is that because you're thinking of a follow-up, perhaps?
Well, I would say this. Almost all fantasy and science fiction is about world building. The books that fans really get into and really like tend to be the ones where the author created a kind of coherent world in which it's possible to tell many stories. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of those, absolutely. I think that if you get to the end of a fantasy or a science fiction novel and you don't say to yourself, I'd like to know what happens next, or I'd like to read another story about the history of this, that, or the other thing, then it suggests that maybe that job didn't get done.
Yeah. Neil, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Ira. It's always a pleasure.
It's a great book. Neil Stephenson is a sci-fi author, and his newest book is called Seven Eves. As I say, a great summer read. And if you want to know what happens after the moon explodes, you can read an excerpt at our website. That's sciencefriday.com/seven eves. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, driving a car these days, you can feel like you're flying a plane. There are backup cameras and LiDAR sensors, onboard systems to help you navigate, others that monitor your fuel efficiency. Tesla announced that their Model S will have an autopilot with a self-parking feature. What if you're still driving a 1977 Gremlin? How can you make your gas guzzler a little more 21st century or use social communities to make your driving a little more convenient? Well, my next guest is here to tell us about a few apps. Yeah, there are apps for that. And they also have gadgets that can help smooth out your driving experience. Damon Lovrens is the Silicon Valley editor of Jalopnik. He's based out there in Stockton, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start off with the apps you use for driving navigation. My favorite is Waze. I don't go anywhere without it. What do you think of that one? Have you got a couple of others?
No, Waze is still very much kind of the gold standard, and you know, mainly because of the fact that all of their information is crowdsourced. So you're getting data from drivers all over the world. They've got a massive user base, and they're pulling in a lot of data, and that's giving you everything from commute times to if there's police activity, that kind of thing. They were also actually acquired by Google a couple years ago, and while they're still kind of an autonomous unit from Google, they've actually started incorporating a lot of that data into Google's own mapping application. So you're starting to see kind of more granular data in actual Google Maps app.
I want to ask our listeners if they have their own favorite apps to get around to give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry with stuff that you can share with us. You know, finding a parking spot, especially here in New York, can be one of the most frustrating parts of driving, and I understand there are a couple of apps that try to tackle this problem. Maybe not here in New York, because it is a big place, so a lot of parking places. But what is your favorite one?
No, I mean, it's a big issue out here in San Francisco as well. I think one of the most frustrating things for me is, well, I'll finally find a parking space, and I'll walk up to the meter, and when I get there, I don't have any coins on me. And there's been a rollout in a lot of different cities of an app called Park and Pay. And you'll see a 8-digit number on the actual parking meter. You open up an app on your phone, you type in that number, and then you can just pay using your credit card. It makes things a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. And so you can add time later if you happen to be running out?
Exactly. As a matter of fact, it'll give you a little alert about 10 minutes before it runs out to say, hey, you need more time on the meter, and here's how to pay for it.
Of course, your garage or your parking meter people are going to have to be, as part of the deal, in on all of this, right, so that it works.
Exactly. And the way the systems have been rolling out, when somebody comes up, when one of the meter maids walks up to the car, they can actually see on their little device that they use, hey, this has been paid for, and you're good to go.
Maybe some way, you know, we have these things called easy passes, the stuff that you use for paying tolls and whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's some way you can integrate it that pays right through that instead of...
We'd hope so. And one of the other ways they're actually starting to do this now is there's a couple different startups that are actually trying to turn, basically, they want to be the Uber for valets. So you would show up to, like, say, a restaurant that doesn't have a traditional valet, and before you arrive, you would set up a pickup time. And about 10 minutes before you got there, somebody's waiting there to take your car to a private parking lot a few blocks away. When you get done with dinner, you call them back up and say, I need my car, and they bring it right back to you.
Well, so it's like your car goes into the car cloud and comes back.
Exactly.
Comes back, hopefully, when you're done with dinner. That's called the Lux Valet. Is that what that is?
Correct. Yeah, and there's a few different companies that have been playing with it. Again, most of them are kind of in beta at this point. They're still rolling out. Again, mainly out in San Francisco, as you would expect. But they seem to be gaining some traction.
Now it seems like there are two types of apps. There are those that tap into existing infrastructure, and those that you'd use crowdsourcing or other people like the Waze does. Is one way more successful than the other?
Well, the thing with the older systems is they're just that. They're older. They're a little more antiquated. Most of the traffic information you'll see on, say, Google Maps or Apple Maps is provided from only a few companies. They're sourcing data from everything from road sensors to commercial fleets, the GPS systems they use on that. The nice thing about Waze or some of these similar apps that are out there, because they're crowdsourcing it, they get much more detailed data, much more granular data about what's happening on particular sections of road and specifically what's happening. They'll say there's police activity here, or there's a car crash, versus just seeing a red line.
Right. Tell me about monkey parking. This looks like it's a follow-up to sort of Uber for parking, right?
Yeah, so monkey parking was an app that now seems to be pretty much dead, and there have been a few people that have tried to do it in the past, but it was basically a way for you to squat on a space, essentially. So if you were parked in the city and you were about to leave that parking space, you would open up the app and tell the people around you, basically, hey, I'm going to leave this space if you need it, and then they would pay you. You basically allow you to bid on that space, and then when you leave, they show up, or when you show up, they leave, and you're on your way. Because that was, of course, those are public parking spaces. They ran into some dubious legal issues with that.
Yeah, because you don't own that spot to rent it out
exactly.
To anybody. But it seems like a good idea. You know, maybe in a different life form somehow.
Yeah, I think it's really all about context. And, you know, if cities are willing to maybe partner with some of these companies, that's certainly a possibility. But right now, like I said, you really can't own or rent out public parking.
All right, now I got to talk about a gadget now, because I'm a gadget guy.
Mm-hmm.
And my producer and I were talking about this gadget, and I saw it, and I said, I have to have one of these. This is, you know what I'm talking about?
I think I've got a pretty good idea,
It's called Automatic.
Mm-hmm.
It's a device you plug into the diagnostic port in your car that the mechanics use.
Exactly.
And you take it from there, because I'm overwhelmed with having one.
If you have a car that's been built after 1996, it's got this little port underneath your dash called an OBD2 port. And basically, like you said, that allows your mechanic to plug in one of their scanners, essentially, and then pull in information about the car. So when you have like a check engine light that pops up, that's how they read that. Well, what Automatic has done is they've made this little device that plugs in and then connects to your phone over Bluetooth. And what that allows it to do is then access a bunch of different information in your car. So it can tell you, as an example, that, you know, if you don't have a new car that has a, it'll tell you how many miles are left until you're empty. It'll tell you, hey, you're about to run out of gas. You need to stop. There's these gas stations close by. They've done a lot of different things with this. When it originally came out 2 years ago, it was more for like driver coaching. So it would tell you, hey, you're accelerating a little too hard or braking a little too hard, and that's affecting your fuel economy. Now they're opening it up just this week to third-party developers. So they're allowing people that want to make apps that use this data as a way to kind of bring your car into the 21st century.
Oh, so they're crowdsourcing apps. People can come up with apps on their own and
exactly,
use
exactly.
It.
So depending on what you're interested in, you can find something that's up your alley. So if you're a kind of a performance junkie, you like to do like track days and that kind of thing, they've got one that'll actually tie into the phone's accelerometer and GPS and camera, and it can record your track day and also overlay throttle, brake, engine, and a bunch of other data onto the screen, so you can watch it later and say, hey, I maybe braked a little too early in this corner, or I didn't accelerate. Yeah. Soon enough out of this corner. There's other ways. If I'm sure you're familiar with the Nest thermostat.
Yeah.
So they've got a way now where it'll communicate with the Nest thermostat to show up to actually increase or decrease the temperature in your house just as you're about to arrive. So it'll actually save you on saving on utilities costs.
Wow.
Yeah, some of the other ones I'm playing with right now, I'm sure if you drive a lot for work, one of the ways this helps is it can actually automatically file your expense account, so it can figure out how much gas you used, what the mileage is, and then it automatically plugs into, like, say, Concur or Expensify to file that stuff automatically with your company to get reimbursed.
Wow, and as you're driving in your driveway, maybe it'll open your garage door for you, knowing that you're getting home.
We're definitely getting there, yeah.
Not to mention the martini that will be starting to be mixed in the automatic bar that you have. But it's that kind of thing. I've seen this, the flow on the insurance ad. She gives you a little plug to plug into that same spot. Are insurance companies looking into these things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, any more data they can get, they're going to be able to tweak your rates accordingly. The larger concern about with a lot of this stuff, obviously, is privacy. And you brought up Progressive earlier. They actually had some privacy issues with their little dongle that they used, where hackers found out they could actually intercept the signals. So there's a bit of a security concern there as well.
Let's go to the phones. Our number 844-724-8255. Joey in Maryland. Hi, Joey.
Hey, how are you doing, Ira?
Hey there.
So I guess I use a combination of apps while I'm driving. My favorite is Scouch, that I've been using for quite a while, since I've had a smartphone, really. And I use that in combination with my onboard nav in the car, as well as Google Maps. And I like using all three, mainly because Scout has a wonderful voice recognition, so if I need to get directions to someplace on the fly, it keeps me relatively hands-free, and I find that very very convenient. And it also gives me notifications if there's like a police speed trap ahead.
Let me ask Damon, do you know about Scout? Is it Scout?
Yeah, no, I'm familiar. They were actually part of a larger mapping acquisition a while ago. And they actually provide really, really great kind of, again, granular data for this.
How is it different than Waze, or is it sort of a clone?
It's similar to less crowdsourcing. They're mainly just pulling in a lot of the data you would find on, say, Google Maps or Apple Maps.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Joey. Good luck with it. Our number is 844-724-8255. What is going to be the ultimate, do you think, Damon? Or is it just the ultimate car, one that just drives itself?
Well, I'm sure, it's going to be still, at least another decade or so until that really starts to proliferate. But I think the larger thing you're going to start seeing in the next few years is the car kind of becoming yet another node in the network. So, I'm sure you've talked about, like, the Internet of Things before, right?
Right.
So the Nest thermostat being a prime example that it's connected. You can control things remotely. And the car, to a certain extent, is just another device, right? It's just another way for you to kind of quantify certain things. So in the case of, like, the automatic, when that originally launched, a lot of us kind of compared it to, like, a Fitbit for your car, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of keep track of health reports and diagnostics and that kind of thing. And as we as we get our cars more connected, we're going to start seeing more ways for insurance companies to reduce our rates, for more data to be pulled in about how much time we're spending on commuting. One of the apps I use a lot right now is called Rescue Time, which keeps track of all the different apps I use on my computer and tells me at the end of the week how much time you spent writing or reading or on email. And now it can incorporate some of the data about how much I'm driving as well.
We're talking with Damon Lavrentz, Silicon Valley editor at Jalopnik on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Years ago when GPS started coming out in cars, first you had the Garmin sort of thing that was on your dashboard, and then the GPS got into the car. And I sort of shied away from buying a car with the stuff built into it because I knew it would be obsolete, right, over the lifetime of the car, and that third-party add-ons, hardware and software, I could buy and add later on my own. What do you recommend, that we buy the stuff that's built in or just wait and add the stuff on ourselves as they come out?
Well, you know, if this was a year ago, I would have said the latter, absolutely. Don't bother with a built-in system. I mean, to be honest with you, I review a lot of cars as part of my job, and more often than not, I don't use the integrated navigation system if I need to get somewhere. I just use the navigation on my phone because it's more current, it's more up-to-date. You know, one thing that a lot of people don't quite understand about these vehicles is they're developed, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago. So, you know, if you bought a car, say, 2 years ago, that car's infotainment system, navigation, all of that was being developed before the original iPhone came out. And because of that long lead time between when the technology is developed and when it's actually put for sale, it means things have gotten a lot better. And that could be screens, that could be software, and that kind of thing. We're now starting to see a lot of automakers looking at their infotainment stack, you know, the stereo and navigation and all that, as something that they can upgrade over time. So they're doing over-the-air software updates now, as an example, and some automakers are even talking about making some of these systems upgradable as far as the hardware is concerned. So a couple years down the road, a new navigation system comes out, you pay a fee at the dealer, and they upgrade both the software and some of the hardware as well.
Yeah, so Tesla upgraded the whole system on its car, right, just by sending it out?
Correct. Yeah, no, they've been the kind of pioneers as far as over-the-air software updates, and I think they're on 6 or 7 releases right now. And it isn't just, you know, bug fixes and that kind of thing. They're actually, you know, pushing out new features on a pretty regular basis. You know, you mentioned earlier about the new Model S being able to park itself. The cars that they've sold, I think, since October or November of last year have the hardware necessary, but they haven't done the software for it yet. So they started shipping the cars with the hardware, and then later this summer, they're actually going to push out a software update that's going to allow for a lot of these autopilot features.
Are we waiting for a killer app, Damon, like they have, you know, on your desktop? Is there a killer car app?
You know, I think it's just going to be a confluence of several different apps that are really going to make it better. You know, again, it's going to depend on if you're driving an older car or a newer car. But there's so much good stuff out there, and we're finally starting to see, you know, me being out in the Bay Area, I'm starting to finally see a lot of the startups and the tech companies out here really putting a lot of focus into automotive. They're really starting to think about automotive more.
Well, the car, as you say, is becoming a computer. So there are car companies are hiring all these computer engineers. Damon? Thank you for taking time to be with us today, and have a great holiday weekend.
Hey, it was a real pleasure.
You're welcome. Damon Lovrins is a Silicon Valley editor at Jalopnik.com. That's all the time we have. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners every week at the studios of the City University of New York. And if you want to go to our Facebook page, please go over there, and if you like us, click on that little like us. And we tweet all week at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. We have all kinds of educational stuff over there on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's a holiday weekend, please. You just heard about all these car apps. Don't test them out while you're driving. Have a great and safe holiday weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.